Country with your host, Dave Woods. This is the radio show where country music gets up close and personal. Spend some time in the country and get to know our kids. Spend some time in the country where the music's the best. The latest news and memories, two great stories that get told. Spend some time in the country, now it's time we start the show.
My bills out the window, catch a train to another town, I'm go back working. I gotta buy my kids a brand new pair of shoes. I drank a little beer in a tavern, cry a little bit of these working man blues. Here comes that working man.
One and only rebel child, from a family meek and mild, my mama seemed to know what lay in store. Despite all my Sunday learning, with the bad I kept on turning, till mama couldn't hold me anymore. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but mama tried, mama tried, mama tried to raise me better. But her pleading I denied, that leaves only me to blame, cause mama tried.
And I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee, a place where even squares can have a ball.
We still wave old glory down at the courthouse.
White lightning still the biggest thrill of all.
Music critic and longtime Merle Haggard fan, David Cantwell has written Merle Haggard, The Running Kind, on the legendary Haggard, whose hits include Mama Tried, Okie from Muskogee, Today I Started Loving You Again, and the list goes on. David pays particular attention to Merle's music in the 60s and 70s and offers great insight into the meaning and significance of the songs. David is also the co-author of the acclaimed book, Heartaches by the Number, Country Music's 500 Greatest Singles, and his work has appeared in Oxford American, Salon, and No Depression, among other publications. He joins me on the line now from Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome to the show, David.
Hey, Dave. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, yeah, it's great to have you here, and I've enjoyed reading the book, Merle Haggard, The Running Kind. You go into great detail about the songs, and I wanted to start off by asking you your decision to write the book focusing on the music over, say, facts about his personal life.
Yeah, I think of it, it often gets called, even in the press materials for the book, it gets called a biography of Merle Haggard, and I don't think that's really fair. It's a little misleading. It's actually what I call a critical monograph, and that's what I'm trying to do, is to focus specifically on his art, on the songs that he wrote, and a related but not the same thing, on the records he made, and you know how meaning is created in his music, not just through the lyrics, but by his great singing voice and his choice of phrasing and texture, by the band, the strangers behind him, and the arrangements they're playing, and how all of that goes together. In concert or in conversation with, you know, other songs that were getting played on the radio at the same time, and the political culture of the times that Haggard is living in, and how all that works together to create meaning and value in his music. And so I think that's I call the book criticism and not so much biography.
Exactly. And his music from that time is a reflection on, as you stated there, what was going on around him politically and just in American culture. And that found its way into his music. So really when we listen to it in that context and think about it, it reflects back what was going on during those times.
Yeah, it definitely does. And I think in a lot of ways Haggard's music has not only reflected its times, like in your opening, you played Okie from Muskogee, which is the song that most people would associate most closely with Haggard. It's the one that even people who don't really know much of anything at all about Merle Haggard, and maybe don't like Merle Haggard, they know that song. And, you know, so that was in, you know, 1969 to early 1970 when that is having its moment. And so what's going on at that time in America, you know, the protest against the Vietnam War, the rise of those hippies, those long-haired, sandal-wearing hippies that Merle talks about in the song, living out in San Francisco. And America's in a time of great flux and change, and his songs are reflecting that. But I think at the same time, you know, the way he sort of crystallizes a lot of those issues, and particularly crystallizes opposition, sort of he becomes a voice, at least in that moment, for Richard Nixon's silent majority. He's like someone who's saying, no, these changes that are taking place, we need to put the brakes on. And that really speaks to the audience of the country audience of the time. And looking, you know, fast-forwarding to our times, I think a lot of songs like Okie from Muskogee, his song Fight Inside of Me, another song from the 80s called Are the Good Times Really Over, those songs are really sort of predicted where country music has gone today. It's very much focused on, you know, telling the audience that there's this whole world of people out there who live their lives certain ways, but we here in the country audience have different values and define ourselves differently. And as he says, you know, Okie from Muskogee, we're proud of it, right?
Yes.
I mean, just for one example, like one of the songs that's nominated in the next couple of weeks for a CMA award and was the opening number on last year's CMA Awards was a Blake Shelton song called Boys Round Here.
Right.
And, you know, so what that song does is say, you know, the boys round here in the country audience, you know, we do these things and we don't do the Dougie.
Yeah.
you know, and the chorus says back to him, you don't do the Dougie? Not in Kentucky. And I think that, you know, what that is very, that's a direct descendant, kind of being able to say, I am proud to be one of the boys from around here who live their lives in this very definitively country way, that can be traced directly back to I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee.
Isn't that something that song still resonates as an identification? He was born in California near Bakersfield.
His parents were both from Oklahoma, and he had two older siblings, and they were significantly older siblings, like, you know, almost fully grown by the time he shows up, you know, well into their teens. They were also both born in Oklahoma. But in 1935, the family left Oklahoma, not from Muskogee, but from the area around Muskogee, Chakota, Oklahoma, and places like that, and went to California. And as you say, settled around Bakersfield in a little suburb would be too refined a term for it. It was, you know, more like a poor white ghetto of oil workers and agricultural workers and, you know, Okie transplants called Oildale, which has long since been incorporated into Bakersfield. But they moved there in 35, and he was born in 37. And I think this is one of the things that's, you know, really interesting about Haggard is that his art is really built around, you know, this kind of connection with Okie culture, with these Okie, or rather Oklahoma culture and Oklahoma origins. But he's not actually from there. He's someone who grew up in a community of a lot of adults who had come from there, though, specifically his parents, and who heard those stories all of his life. So a lot of this, his identification with Okiness in the strict sense, of, you know, packing up the truck and moving to California, that we think about from, like, the John Steinbeck novels and the John Ford movies and all that kind of stuff. That was something that he never actually experienced himself. But he did, you know, hear about it and empathize with it and turn those imaginings and that empathy into art.
Now, a lot of his own personal life came out in his songs as far as his time spent in prison, a lot of his songs about that, and of course a lot of his songs about heartache, and which came from you know, times in his life. So he was a very personal songwriter. He wasn't singing and writing songs that he hadn't lived or at least experienced in some way.
Yeah, in some way. I think that's a really really key distinction. He's a lot of times when we think of songwriters as we call them autobiographical songwriters and are trying to say that, you know, what they are singing about is the things that they've actually experienced in real life.
Right.
And it's almost like they're like taking musical dictation. You know, they're taking, you know, just the transcript of their life and putting it to a melody. And Haggard definitely has songs where he's writing from his own experience. Maybe the most famous of those would be Mama Tried, which when he talks about having a mother who tried to raise him right, but he refused, and that his bad choices, you know, eventually led him to being in prison on his 21st birthday. And that's exactly true, right? And just as that song talks about him hearing a freight train calling and, you know, jumping on that freight train and taking it to another town, not knowing where he's bound, he did that too when he was very young. The first time he hopped a freight, I believe, was when he was 10 years old. Scared his mother to death. And so that's all true, but at the same time, we also know that in that song, it begins, "I turned 21 in prison doing life without parole." Well, he wasn't doing life without parole, or we would never have heard of him. He was actually in there doing like 3 to 15 years. In one of his interviews many years ago, he told a reporter that, you know, "I tried to say 3 to 15 years, but I just couldn't get that to rhyme." And I think that is a really, that's a powerful insight that Haggard has never been willing to say. He's certainly been inspired by his own life events, but if he needs to change it because it helps him rhyme or because it just makes the song more dramatic, besides not rhyming, saying 3 to 15 years instead of life without parole, it doesn't sound as impressive, right? It doesn't sound as beaten down and trapped. So, and he's done that throughout his life. You know, the maybe my favorite of his songs, and it's a tough thing to pick, but I usually default to his song "Hungry Eyes," sometimes called "Mama's Hungry Eyes," where he talks about, you know, living in a canvas covered cabin in a crowded labor camp with his mother and his father. And, you know, again, this is Haggard twisting the truth of what actually happened. He never was in a canvas-covered cabin with his parents. After his father died when he was 9, he would sometimes spend time with family friends who did live in labor camps. But he was never there, so he never actually saw his mother's hungry eyes in that setting. And his father, by the time he would have been in that setting, had already passed away. And so he's constantly doing that, is like taking something that happened to him, or other times maybe just something that he saw happen to someone else, and invest it with you know, his own imagination and his own just rock solid songwriting craft.
Yeah.
And turning it into things that sure sound as if they happened to him when we hear him sing them,
Didn't. That's a real gift, too, to be able to, whether you lived it directly or not or observed it, to be able to write about it, first of all, and then sing it in such a way as he did that people listening believed it. Because, I mean, a song is there to move us and doesn't have to be totally factual, I believe. It just needs to move us in some way.
Yeah, oh, definitely. I think that's the gig.
Well, I like your interpretation. You spoke of the song "Mama Tried," and in the book, you talk about the lyrics may speak of regret, but he sings it in a victorious way. So it's not necessarily an apology or feeling bad that his mama tried and he didn't, he wasn't tamed, but it was more like I was able to get past this, or it speaks of his determination.
Yeah. That's a good. Earlier, I mentioned like the difference between songs and records, and I think if we just like read the lyrics to "Mama Tried" on the page, you could really say, "Wow, this is a song about this son regretting the bad choices he made and regretting that he didn't take his mother's advice and ruining how much he must have hurt his mother and scared her through the years with his bad choices." and I've heard other people do the song, and that's what it sounds like. But when Haggard, you know, not just the song, but when he went actually made the record in Capitol Studios in, what, 1967 or 68, that record just sounds thrilling. It does not sound regretful at all, right? It's got that great rhythm that's pushing towards freight train, like he's chasing after the next freight train to hop and go who knows where. And that chorus, which is those ascending shouts, Mama tried, Mama tried, Mama tried. I mean, that sounds like victory. That's what I mean when I said it sounds like victory. And that's a running theme throughout Haggard's work, is that, you know, he likes to be the boss of himself. He likes to be the one who's in charge and values that, you know, values his freedom in that sense. Even if, I mean, he values his freedom to make bad choices. And so
that's right.
The more I listened to that song, the more I began to think, you know, this really isn't a good, I dedicate this to my mother on Mother's Day kind of song. It's more like him sort of celebrating the fact that nobody could tell him what to do, not even his own mother.
Now, some of his influences that made his way, that made its way into his music and that he admired early on was Jimmy Rogers. And he, as it states in your book, he first discovered Jimmy Rogers through a tribute album that Lefty Frizzell had did of Rogers' music. So this was a big influence on Merle, and he later did his own tribute album for Jimmy Rogers.
Yeah, if you went through Merle's catalog and just started picking up and started eliminating the albums that are tribute albums to other artists or songs that are tributes to other artists where he's actually written the song himself that's about some artist he admires. Like when in the middle 70s when Lefty Frizzell died, he wrote a song called Goodbye Lefty. If you eliminate tribute albums and those type of songs, and you eliminate all the covers of songs that he did of other by other artists he admired, you would almost have his catalog. I mean, he is one of those artists who sort of as I think this is one of the things that makes him sort of an exemplary country artist, is that he really he doesn't just talk how much he admires these earlier figures. He walks the walk. He gets out there and sings their songs and talks them up in interviews and does tribute albums to them. As far as Jimmy Rogers goes, his first great influence was Lefty Frizzell. He loved Lefty. And the story I recount in the book, which is actually from an interview that Merle Haggard did with the writer Barry Mazur. And Merle told Barry that, you know, one day they were sitting around the house and this song came on, and Merle recognized Lefty Frizzell's voice, who was his hero. And he said, "Oh, Mom, Lefty's got a new song." And Merle said, "Actually, that's not a Lefty Frizzell song. That's a Jimmy Rogers song," although Lefty was doing it. And at that point in his life, Merle was, you know, he was, you know, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old. And, well, actually a little older than that because he was born in 37. This would have been in approximately 51, so 13, maybe a little older than that. And so from then on, he said, "Okay, well, if Lefty Frizzell likes this Jimmy Rogers guy, then I need to find out as much about Jimmy Rogers as I can." And so he proceeded to do exactly that. When he knew the Rogers catalog first, as you said, through that Lefty Frizzell tribute album that came out in the early 1950s, his mother bought him some, not the actual album, but some of the old 78 RPM singles.
Right.
And at that point in his life, he was spending a lot of time in detention hall there in Bakersfield, at first for truancy and then for running away from detention hall. And so he had spent so much time there eventually that he had his own little record collection that he kept in the rec room. And one of those records was Rough and Rowdy Ways, which was Lefty Frizzell's version of the old Jimmy Rogers song.
Right.
And and then as you said later, later in his career, in approximately 1969, he has an entire album devoted to Jimmy Rogers, Same Train, Different Time. And one of the things that's interesting about that record, too, is that he, although he's doing all Jimmy Rogers songs You know, he doesn't do them. He doesn't. The record doesn't sound like a Jimmy Rogers record, and it doesn't even sound like a Lefty Frizzell record, which is who he learned the songs from.
Yeah.
It sounds like a Merle Haggard record in 1969, and this is, I think, that something else is, that marks him as exemplary in the country field is that he's while he's constantly looking backward and connecting himself and what he's doing to earlier artists, he's also always updating what has happened in the past to meet the now. And that's one of my favorite of his albums, is that Rogers tribute.
There's great stories like that in the book, which is called Merle Haggard, The Running Kind, written by my guest, David Cantwell. For those interested in purchasing that book, you can head to the University of Texas Press website. This book, by the way, is part of their American Music series, and the website is utexaspress.com. That's U as in university, texaspress.com, and just search for David Cantwell, and you'll find the book. There are great stories, as we've been talking about and we'll continue to talk about. Now, Okie from Muskogee, which we talked about earlier, became such a song of identification for people, I guess not only from Oklahoma, but maybe across America, just that small town way of life and being proud of that. Now, did the song itself come from a bit of humor in the beginning, maybe not as serious as the song eventually became?
Yeah, I think that at the time, when that the song first got on the radio and became a hit, or even before that, when he first started playing it out at shows, the response he got to it, you know, really stunned him because people were taking it dead seriously when, in fact, yeah, it had been written with at least, you know, a good portion of a tongue and a good portion of his cheek. It was, the story goes that he was in the bus with the band and they were driving along, maybe in Arkansas or maybe they were already in Oklahoma, and they spotted a sign that said Muskogee was, you know, this number of miles down the road. And somebody on the bus, it might have been Merle, it might have been drummer Cliff Burris, said, "I bet they don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee." And everybody on the bus cracks up. The reason for that was because they were passing a joint around. They begin to sort of brainstorm, okay, what else don't they do in Muskogee? So, you know, they don't do LSD, they don't let their hair grow long and shaggy, they don't wear Roman sandals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the things that go into the song. And they thought it was kind of funny, and from that perspective, it's sort of, you know, if it is funny, then we could ask, like, well, who's the joke on? What's the funny part? Well, the funny part was that these musicians who had come from similarly small-town, humble roots, had become pretty worldly. You know, they had traveled around the country, and they, although they were from that culture, they also recognized that they'd seen a lot more of the world and weren't from that culture anymore, too. And so they're kind of, you know, looking, I wouldn't say they're looking down their noses, but they're kind of saying, like, you know, there before the grace of God go I. You know, they're looking, they're sort of tweaking the nose of these small-town morals and mores. But when the audience began to hear this song, they did not at all think that they were being mocked in any way. They thought that this was a song that was standing up for exactly the things that they believed in. And at that point, Haggard, who I think probably, you know, that was part of the song to begin with, right? This is typical Haggard, is that he feels ambivalent about things. He feels both ways about things. He can sort of look down on the silly small town, the things about small town life that are limiting and can be provincial, but also cherish them. He can do both of those things at the same time. And so I think both of those sides were in the song to begin with. And when the audience responded to one side, the earnest, we're proud side, he latched onto that and ran with it straight to the fighting side of me, which takes a lot of those same concerns and then doubles down on them. That's not a song that has any bit of humor in it whatsoever. And
that's a great interpretation of the song. Now, can you take us back, David, to when Merle Haggard became important to you? And I understand it was at quite a young age. When did you get turned on to his music and become such a big fan?
Yeah, I don't tell this entire I just allude to this in the introduction to the book, but the actual story is that, you know, I was 9 years old and was living in a working-class neighborhood in South Kansas City, Missouri, and had just begun to earn just a little bit. I had a small allowance from my parents, and then I was also beginning to get a little extra money because I was mowing the lawn. And I finally had saved up enough money, and I was going to go to the nearby shopping center. It's actually a strip mall. And I got on my yellow bike and rode up there, and I was going to buy a record that I'd had my eyes on for a long, long time. And the record was The Fight Inside of Me by Merle Haggard. But they didn't have it. They were sold out of it. And so I got my second favorite choice at that time, which was Edwin Starr's really hard funk Motown record, War. War, What Is It Good For? Absolutely Nothing.
Yeah.
And at the time, it didn't really occur to me that those two songs were about as diametrically opposed as two songs could possibly be. I liked them both because I thought they both sounded cool. You know, so that's where I sort of came in to liking Merle Haggard, was because I had heard Fight Inside of Me on the same local top 40 station, WHB, the world's happiest broadcaster, 710 AM on your radio dial. I'd heard them both on the same radio station. Because at least in Kansas City, you know, Merle Haggard's records, you know, got played sometimes.
Right.
And to me, it didn't that whole, like, well, you know, this idea that, well, this is a country record, and no, that's a soul record, or that's a pop record. I understood those distinctions, but they mainly just all seemed like records that I liked, and you could play and listen to any of them. The bass line in that Fight Inside of Me, that boom, 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 which was just cool sounding, and it had a real pop sensibility to it, and I only found this out when I actually did the research for the book, is that the guy that plays the bass on that is the same man who played the bass on These Boots Were Made for Walking by Nancy Sinatra, which, if you remember, has the same kind of boom, 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 boom bass sound on it. Eventually, I began to, it became apparent to me that a song like Fight Inside and a song like War were very, very different records, expressing very different sensibilities. And so I've been sort of like singing along with Merle Haggard records ever since. And I don't always agree with them, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to write a book. But I always sing along. I always love his music, even when I'm disagreeing with any point he might be making. So my love for him goes a long, long way back.
Goes way back, right? 38 number one hits for Merle Haggard. I'm looking at the list here. Now, one of them I was listening to earlier as I was getting reacquainted with a lot of his music is Big City. One of my favorites, Big City, Turn Me Loose, which I, by the sound of it, I thought would have been a record maybe from the 70s, but it was actually 1981. So for that time, it was pretty traditional song, but it did well for him, went to number one. Is that one of your favorites, and what's the significance of that song in the early 80s?
It's, yeah, you're right. It does have kind of an old school sound. It's one of the things that Merle has said about it is that he was never a big fan of kind of old school shuffles, which
right.
that song is. And if you think about it, you know, if you listen to his other records, even when he's doing like honky tonk songs that are danceable, they're not shuffles. And he attributed his aversion to doing shuffles to how many of them he'd had to play as a young musician coming up in the Bakersfield scene, and he just got tired of them. But that record definitely has a shuffle. They decided to use it there. So it has an older kind of sounding quality, you know, that smack dab in the Urban Cowboy era when songs aren't sounding so old school. So that kind of distinguished it. But it's also, you know, that's early in the Reagan years. Right, Reagan has just come into office, and so I think a lot of just as Okie from Muskogee has sort of captured some of the important moments, the political tensions in circa 1970, Big City captures those tensions for America in the 1980s, especially that whole idea of, you know, he's singing about, you know, what's the line about you can keep your retirement and your so-called Social Security.
That right.
So-called
yes.
Priceless.
Yeah.
at a time
making
when,
a
you know,
there.
Right, at a time when Reagan is, during his first inaugural, is saying government is not the solution to our problems, government is the problem. Reagan is, again, sort of in step with one part of a national conversation saying, you know, no, you can keep your Social Security. I value a different kind of freedom, the freedom to be left alone, the freedom to, in the song, what he wants to do is to be let loose in the middle of Montana, presumably just to sort of fend for himself. Maybe he has a knife or a gun, and he's going to camp out, and, you know, that's kind of a fantasy of freedom, you know. Maybe it's something you'd like to do for a weekend, but most of us would rather be where the people are in the big city, where there are jobs and those sorts of things. But I think that, and again, that's a kind of a conflicted notion in country music and in Merle Haggard's music, and he's right there on the cutting edge of an attitude that, again, has been with us ever since in country music.
Right, and if we go back to the start, as we mentioned, the theme of prison reflects or resonates in his songs in many of them. And there was an interview we did recently. I was reading, and the interviewer asked him, "You were in the audience when Johnny Cash performed at San Quentin in 1958," and Merle said, "Yes." The funny thing is, when he later told Johnny about this, he said, "Oh, I didn't recall you performing that day." So I guess at first Johnny didn't realize that. But when we go back to the start, there's "I'm a Lonesome Fugitive," and then a couple of singles later, a couple of number ones later, "Sing Me Back Home," which is a beautiful song about someone in prison, and it touches you. It's a very touching song from 67.
Yeah, that's "Sing Me Back Home" is just really gorgeous. And, you know, that's... You kind of are left speechless when you try to be eloquent when you're talking about a song that's already about as eloquent and perfect as you could imagine.
Yes.
The immediate sort of prod for Merle to write that song was thinking about some of the people that he had known when he was in prison. He was a troublemaker when he first got there, had considered escaping, had gotten into sort of like a group of prisoners who were like making homebrew there in the prison and selling it, and he got caught drunk on his own homebrew and was sentenced, punished by a week in solitary confinement in a part of San Quentin that was called the Shelf, and that's where the solitary confinement people were. But it abutted the death row of San Quentin, and so he spent a week up there by himself, but also listening to these doomed men talk up in, you know, and it really left a lasting impression on him, as did, you know, when he actually would see one of these men being taken, being led to the gas chamber.
Right.
And so that, and the fascinating thing about the song is, you know, that the song is just about the fact that here are these human beings who are dying, who are scared, who are looking for something that momentarily will take their mind off it. The first verse, the dead man walking asks for my guitar playing friend to do my request, sing me this song that my mama used to sing. And then in the second verse, a choir from off the street comes in and says, and he asks them, can you sing this song that my mama used to sing? And it's just a really beautiful sort of thing that humanizes people that, you know, at least in the context of the song, have probably done terrible things, and yet when they die, it's going to be a loss to humanity,
right.
Certainly to their immediate families.
Yeah.
And he just mourns that loss in the song so beautifully and so eloquently. It's just gorgeous. gorgeous thing.
It's a gorgeous song. It's so great to be reminded of these songs for anybody who hasn't heard them in a while, and go back and listen to them because they are beautiful songs. Now, there's even a story in the book, Merle Haggard, The Running Kind, the book that you wrote, that talks about a song, I think it might be, is only one that was pretty controversial, as far as controversial enough that they didn't release it, the song Irma Jackson.
I'm sorry, what was the song?
Irma Jackson.
Oh, right, sure. Irma Jackson should have been, he wanted it to be the follow-up single to Okie from Muskogee.
Right.
And wrote it, and it's a song about an interracial love affair. In the song, Irma Jackson Merle is presumably playing some version of himself, and he's in love with this woman named Irma Jackson, who's a black woman. And they first met when they were children, but as they got older, they fell in love. And now Irma Jackson and he have decided, it seems like mostly it's Irma's decision, that they're going to split up. She's going to go away because the world will just not understand that love is colorblind, as the song puts it.
Yeah.
And that's a fantastic song, too. I mean, Merle once said, I don't know if he would say this now, but that album was recorded right around Thanksgiving of 69. But it didn't actually come out until, I believe, 73. I could have that year wrong, on an album called Let Me Tell You About a Song. And that's a song that every one of the tracks on the album, he gives a little spoken word introduction about how he came up with it. And he talks about that song and says, you know, I didn't release this at the time because maybe the world wasn't ready for it, but I think it's maybe the best song I've ever written. And you could certainly make an argument for it. It really is a remarkably concise statement of the walls that human beings put between themselves, and the melody's gorgeous, and he sings it stunningly.
Yeah.
And so he takes this song into Ken Nelson, his producer there at Capitol, and I don't think he's ever said this, but other people have surmised that they refused to put it out. What it seems more likely to me, since Merle Haggard was on the heels of Okie from Muskogee and was their most, you know, lucrative artist, he could have put out just about anything he wanted. But that they did persuade him that it might not be a good idea, and so he didn't put it out. And instead, he went with Fight Inside of Me. And that's, if you just think about what, you know, how Haggard's career might have gone differently. In the book,
yeah.
I surmise that if he had released Irma Jackson, which is, you know, which would have fit in really well sonically on pop radio at that time, Okie from Muskogee had just become a minor pop hit itself, so he was already on the pop consciousness, or he was already, you know, the pop audience was conscious of him, and if he'd come back with this song, that it has at least the potential of having a liberal message to be taken from it, how wrong it is to keep people in love apart, then it could have been a big, big record for him. But instead, a big, big pop record, I mean, and he could have had a big pop hit in the same way that Johnny Cash was having pop hits, or that Dolly Parton would have pop hits before very long. But instead, he comes out with The Fight Inside of Me, which you know, which maybe in the South and in certain parts of the Midwest where I'm from, got a little bit of top 40 airplay. It wasn't going to be a hit, and it's sort of like, you know, he had this moment when he could have been, I call it in the book the Muskogee moment, this moment when he could have become a pop star, if that's the direction that he'd wanted to. But Fight Inside of Me pretty much pulled the rug out from under that, and he returned to being a country star.
Exactly. That song is very country, very American, and of course people might dispute it or not, but it's got a very strong point of view in it. Fast forward to the early 80s, and he's done a couple of duet albums. I always love this, whether it's a male-female or male-male in this case. He did the Taste of Yesterday's Wine duet album with George Jones, and in the same time period, Poncho and Lefty, which I think that was the name of the album as well as the song, and that was with Willie Nelson. Was he a big fan of teaming up with his contemporaries for recordings?
No, he was not. I think that, you know, just like Merle oftentimes sings about, you know, how independent he is, how he wants to be free, you know, a lot of songs like The Way I Am, which is a Sonny Throckmorton hit he had in the late 70s. My Own Kind of Hat, he has a song called I Can't Be Myself When I'm With You. You know, he's constantly singing this idea that he wants to sort of, you know, be in charge of himself, and anybody who wants to make any demands upon him is inhibiting his freedom. And so, yeah, he's not someone who's like says, hey, yeah, let's team up and do a duet and share the responsibility. But when he did that in the early 80s, it was kind of surprising. He had, you know, he really didn't have any history before that of doing duets at all. He'd done one album with his second wife, Bonnie Owens, the great Bonnie Owens, and his longtime backing singer, way back at the beginning of his career in 1964, I think. But, you know, he hadn't done anything since then. But those two records, he had just switched. They come right on the heels of the Big City album you talked about earlier. And they're just really, really remarkable records. I think he was on a new label. And also, I think, you know, like we said, this is the Urban Cowboy years, so there's a lot going on in country radio, and he's trying to figure out novel ways to make sure he keeps his name there. Right. And it was just a very productive time for him, too. He was writing again after a lull there in the late 70s when he had some good songs, but when he wasn't writing them as many strong songs. But in the early 80s, he's on a roll there. There's a, you know, a good 18-month period when he puts out, you know, I think, you know, the two duet albums, the Big City album, Going Where the Lonely Go, which was a very romantically themed album that he recorded at the same time as Big City. He also had a Christmas album that came out at that time. And he also did a duet album right around the same time with his third wife, the songwriter Leona Williams. And all of those things come out in about 16 months. And you could take those and put them up against anybody else's career, and he would come out on top. It's just a really amazingly productive time for him.
Now, if we fast forward to the present, David, and the last, 5 years or somewhere in that time frame, more recent, what is his music about these days? Has he mellowed out? Has the music changed? Is it just more of what we've come to expect and love for Merle?
Yes, yes, and yes. I think that he's definitely mellowed in the sense that he writes songs now. On some of his most recent albums, he's written songs about how, although he still has to go out back on the road and tour, that maybe he's becoming tired of being the running kind, of having rambling fever all the time, that maybe he would just now like to stay home with his wife, Teresa, and his children. And so that's a change, I think. That happens to a lot of people, but it's definitely happening to him. And I think that's also indicative of a change in his music as well. In that, you know, it used to be that although he would draw upon personal experiences, a lot of his music wasn't really all that strictly autobiographical. I think now, in the 21st century, he has really become the autobiographical songwriter that everybody said he was all along. He's really focused on life with Teresa. He writes songs to his children. He has a really beautiful song. I can't even think of the name of it right now. On one of his last two albums, where he's singing to his children about how this is when they're still pretty young, and he's saying, I know that someday you're going to find out that I was in prison, right? And I hope that you'll still love me. It's just a gorgeous, vulnerable moment. Just really nice, and that's changed as well. And then his, but he's still the same stubborn, independent person he's always been, and I think sometimes that comes through in his willingness to say, you know, everybody thinks I'm this, you know, kind of reactionary hyper-patriot who's always going to take the conservative position, but, you know, his political views certainly seem to have changed in the last decade. He wrote a song in 2008 urging Hillary Clinton to run for president. That song was not a joke. He was serious about it. And then when Barack Obama was elected president, he posted on his own website a poem I don't know if there was ever music to it, but a poem about, you know, how exciting this was, that this change was taking place. And those were positions. A third position like that would be when he came out in defense of the Dixie Chicks, when the rest of the country music world was turning against them.
That's right, yeah.
He came out and said, you know, hey, we got this thing called free speech. And so there's Haggard again standing up for freedom and individual choices. So in that way, he's still the same old Haggard he's always been. And, you know, God bless him.
And on a commercial level, success throughout his career, one of the biggest songs of his as far as other people cutting it, and so many people know the song, Today I Started Loving You Again. It's become duets. It's, you know, everybody has covered this song. It's such a beautiful song, and I think you said when he sings it, maybe differently than others, he sings it with a bit of regret in the sense of, I want to stop loving you, but it started again.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people, I mean, you're right, it has been done. You know, within the time that he came out with that song, I think in 68, and he never released it as a single himself. It was the B-side of another song, and I forget what it is now. But within the next, you know, between the time he cut it and the time that Sammy Smith, the great Sammy Smith, Help Me Make It Through the Night, was her big hit.
Yeah.
Chris Christopherson's song in 1970. She had a top 10 hit with Today I Started Loving You Again in, I think, 75. And in between there, you know, over 60 different versions have been done of the song just by country singers.
Amazing.
And it's been continued to be recorded since. And usually, not always, but usually people sing it like it's a happy thing. You know, I had fallen out of love with you, but now, thank God, today I started loving you again.
Right.
But Merle thinks it very clearly, like, no, this is loving you again is the worst thing that could possibly happen because you still don't love me.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's there in the words, but it's really there in his phrasing and in his tone. And just the way the melody, I think, of that song, which is so bittersweet.
Yes, it is. Sure.
At once the beauty and just the ugly pain of wanting something you're not going to have.
It's so interesting to hear these interpretations of the song. Some of them obvious in a sense when you read the lyrics or hear the song, but others are brought to light by what you've written about, and it sort of makes you take a second listen to them and understand the songs a little better. A great book for discussion as well. It has been such a pleasure having you here, David, to talk about your book, Merle Haggard, The Running Kind. And once again, I'll let our listeners know it's published by the University of Texas Press as part of their American Music Series, and the place to get this book online, several places, but in particular the website utexaspress.com. That's U for university, texaspress.com, and just search David Cantwell and you'll be able to order this book full of great stories. Thanks, David, for being part of the show.
Thank you so much for having me on. I had fun.
Awesome. It's been my pleasure. Once again, my guest has been author David Cantwell. I'm Dave Woods. For more country music interviews, be sure to head to inthecountryinterviews.com.